In our second conference now, we're going to begin on page 308, The Cure of a Blind Man at Capernaum. Now the scene, Jesus is in the doorway of Peter's house in Capernaum. It is morning, the town is busy, women going to the well, men preparing their nets for fishing. Peter, Andrew, James, and John are getting ready to go fishing. Jesus is watching them and asks to help them. They show him how to hold the large net and explain how they release it as the two boats go out on the lake. They strongly advise Jesus to hold onto the net as it becomes full of fish, or otherwise they will lose their day's pay. They ask him, quote, "Keep an eye on the net, that jolts may not turn it over." The fish fight for their freedom with strong strokes in their tails. And if 10, 100, or 1,000 get together, they become strong, strong as a whale. So Jesus then listens and he draws a lesson from this, which he gives them. On page 310, we pick up that lesson. So he says, the same thing happens with sins. Peter, after all, one fault is not irretrievable. But if one is not careful in controlling oneself, and one adds fault to fault, at the end of a little fault, perhaps a single omission or a simple weakness becomes bigger and bigger. It becomes a habit. It becomes a capital vice. At times, one starts with a lustful glance and ends up by committing adultery. At times, while simply lacking charity, when speaking to a relative, one ends up by doing violence to one's neighbor. Never, never allow faults to increase in gravity and in numbers. If you wish to avoid trouble, they become dangerous and overbearing like the infernal snake himself. He's referring to Satan. And they will drag you down into Gehenna. That's another word for hell. What you say is right, Master, but we are so weak. And Jesus says, care and prayer are necessary to become strong and help others together with a strong will not to sin. And you must have full trust in the loving justice of the Father. So then notice what he says there. Care and prayer. See? To become strong and obtain help. Now after this lesson, Jesus introduces Mary to the new disciples and tells her that,
let's go back to care and prayer.
Then Jesus says, or Simon says, do you think he will not be too severe with poor Simon? Remember, Peter sees himself as a bad guy. Jesus reassures him that the Father might have been severe with the old Simon, but with the new Simon, the man of Christ, he will love him. And Jesus goes on to say that in his kingdom, there will be many chosen like his disciples. Down through the centuries, there will be followers who will be faithful to him. Speaking of the spiritual net that Jesus will cast over mankind, he says, notwithstanding the envious malice of Satan and the weak will of men, my haul will be more plentiful than yours. Now, James and John were just arriving, and Peter thought they would be too late for the fishing. John explains that on the way, they met a blind man, and that he was looking for Jesus, and came to John's home by mistake. He did not want to wait until the next day, but wanted to meet Jesus. So James led him to where Jesus was on the shore. And Peter is eager to go fishing while the time is right. But Jesus restrains him, saying, you will have a good haul, even if you are the last one to go out. So the blind man now stands in front of Jesus. He has been blind for 7 years. He was a blacksmith in Caesarea, married, with 3 children, and an old mother, both of whom tried to earn the food they eat. Simon the Zealot was the one who told him about Jesus. And he quotes Simon. And so we pick up the trend here on page 312, the last paragraph. When he says, what did he tell you? And Simon says, that you can do everything, that you are the health of bodies and of souls, that you are a light for souls and bodies, because you are the light of God. He, although a leper, had dared to mingle with the crowd at the risk of being stoned, all enveloped in his mantle, because he had seen you passing by on the way to the mountain, and your face had kindled hope in his heart. He said to me, I saw something in that face that whispered to me, there is health there, go. And I went. Then he repeated your speech to me, and he told me that you cured him, touching him with your hand without any disgust. He was coming back from the priest after his purification. I knew him. I had done some work for him when he had a store at Caesarea. I came asking for you in every town and village. Now I have found you. Have mercy on me. And Jesus says, come. The light is still too bright for one coming out of darkness. And so he takes him to the house, Peter's house, where the light will not be strong for his recovered sight, and places him in front of him. And then Jesus says on page 313, he's praying now, Father, your light to this son of yours. He has stretched his hands over the head of the kneeling man. He remains in that attitude for a moment. He then moistens the tips of his fingers with saliva, and with his right hand touches lightly the open but lifeless eyes. A moment. Then the man blinks, rubs his eyelids as if he were awaking from sleep, and his eyes were dimmed. What do you see? Oh, eternal God, I think, that I can see. I see your mantle. Isn't it red? And a white hand and a woolen belt. Oh, good Jesus, I can see better and better the more I get used to seeing. There's the grass of the earth, and there is certainly a well, and there is a vine. Stand up, my friend. The man who is crying and laughing stands up, and after a moment's hesitation between respect and desire, he lifts his face and meets Jesus' eyes. Jesus smiling, full of merciful love. It must be beautiful to recover your sight and see that face as the first thing. The man gives a scream and stretches his arms. It is an instinctive action, but he controls himself. But Jesus opens his arms and draws to himself the man who is much lower than he. Go home now and be happy and just. Go with my peace. So now that he has his sight, the blind man is overwhelmed. He's full of praise and gratitude, and he adds, it is in your eyes that I see the most beautiful and clear blue, and in you I see the beauty of the most real sun and the chaste light of the blessed moon. You are the star of those who suffer, the light of the blind, the living, active mercy. Jesus says, I am the light of souls. Be a son of the light. Blessed be the Most High Father. Go. And then Jesus and the disciples begin their fishing. And now we begin with the chapter where the demoniac in Capernaum is cured in the synagogue. There's a large crowd of people gathered in the synagogue at Capernaum. They're excitedly awaiting the arrival of the rabbi. He's now known commonly as the rabbi or the Messiah. And there's a shout as Jesus enters the door and greets them with, "May peace be with all those seeking the truth." As he moves towards the front of the synagogue, he is met by a young man who asks Jesus to heal him. He seems to be consumptive, and Jesus asks him to wait until he has spoken to the people. Others also begin to bring their sick in preparation for the healing that will take place. The head of the synagogue asks Jesus what he would like to read from scriptures, and Jesus says, "Whatever you wish, at random, the Spirit will be our guide." Now there is an example of you asking in scripture what the Lord wants you to do, and you open it up at random. He points to a text that Jesus reads from Joshua 7:13, and this is page 315. The second paragraph to the top. The reading is, "Joshua, rise and sanctify the people and say to them, sanctify yourselves for tomorrow, because the Lord of Israel declares, the ban is now among you, Israel. You can never stand up to your enemies until you take from among you him who is contaminated by such crime." And Jesus comments. He says that he is the one who has come to sanctify God's people, that he has prepared and purified himself for his mission, and he points out that the kingdom he is to establish, and of which he will be the future king, is not to be set up by arms and bloodshedding. Only the good, meek, continent, merciful, humble, patient, and those who love God and their neighbors will enter that kingdom. He urges them to repent of their sins so as to be ready for the kingdom. And he says, "Repent with a firm will that makes you change your ways of living and return to the law of the Lord. The kingdom of heaven is waiting for you." Now, a wealthy Israelite confronts him. He contradicts Jesus and questions Jesus' claim to be from God. And then Jesus answered his question, page 317, middle of the page. He says, "The prophets could not say of themselves what I state of myself. Who am I? The expected one, the promised one, the Savior. You have already heard his precursor say," that's John the Baptist, "prepare the way for the Lord. Here the Lord God is coming. Like a shepherd he will feed his flock, although he is the lamb of the true Passover. Many amongst you heard these words from the precursor, and they saw the heavens brighten with the light that descended in the shape of a dove." Now there's a description of what happened at that time. "Light," he said, "in the shape of a dove. And they heard a voice speak." So the people heard it, not just John. And they heard him say, "Who I am. By whose order do I speak? By the order of him who is and who sends me." Now the objector answers that word, that those words may be said that are holy, but Satan sometimes uses deceitful words covered with holiness to deceive people. But Jesus answered, "Someone else, another, will speak who does not love me and will say who I am. Wait till I call one of the people present here." This is a way of proving that someone else will give him the title he deserves. Jesus then calls out in a loud voice, "Aggeus, come here. It is an order." A woman brings up a man who is violently shaking all over his body. Jesus asks her if she knows the man, and she confirms the name, Aggeus. She also says that he is possessed by an evil spirit that tortures him with sudden bouts of fury. Now Jesus asks the crowd if they know the man, and all shout, "Yes." And Jesus says, "Does the man know Jesus, or has he spoken to Jesus and all shout, "No, no! He is half-witted, never leaves his house, and no one has seen Jesus in that house." So now the possessed man is dragged in front of Jesus while the crowd moves away towards the walls. And the head of the synagogue warns Jesus to be careful that the devil is about to torture the man who rushes at people, scratches and bites them. And this is where we pick up the scene of the exorcism, page 318, towards the middle atop of the page. Jesus and the man are now facing each other. There is a moment's struggle. The man, usually mute, seems to have difficulty in speaking. He moans. Then his voice turns into words. "What is there between us and you, Jesus of Nazareth? Why have you come to torture us? Why do you want to destroy us, you, the Lord of heaven and earth? I know who you are, the Holy of God. No one in human flesh was ever greater than you, because in your flesh of man is enclosed the spirit of the eternal winner. You have already beaten me in," and he doesn't finish. And Jesus says, "Be quiet. I order you to come out of this man." And immediately after that, the possessed man moves into a strange convulsions. His body is tossed about by jerks and thrusts by an unseen hand that is ill-treating him violently. He shouts with a wild voice, foams at the mouth, and is tossed down to the ground. Then he gets up with a look of astonishment. He's cured. Jesus now faces his objector and asks, "What do you say now?" His arrogant opponent shrugs his shoulders. He knows he's beaten and leaves without a word amid the jeers of the crowd and the praises of Jesus. Jesus then calls the young man who asked for healing before he began to speak in the synagogue. And Jesus simply says, "You believe me. Be cured. Go in peace and be just." And now he cures a little boy with paralyzed legs who runs to his mother, cured. Then a little old blind man, led by his daughter, is cured with a caress on his eyes by Jesus. There's a roar of blessings from the crowd while Jesus makes his way through them with the help of his disciples pushing ahead of him. And now we move on to the chapter Simon Peter's mother-in-law is cured. You're going to laugh at some of this. 3:19. Peter is talking to Jesus. He's inviting him to come to the home of his mother-in-law and cure her. He probably meant that in more ways than one. He also indicates that his mother-in-law does not believe in Jesus and his healing power. She also has ill feelings for Peter. Jesus goes with Peter, and when they arrive at the house, they are told that she's quite ill, and the doctor sees no cure for her, and that she will die. And Jesus asks Peter to take him to her. But Peter has misgivings and tries to excuse himself. But Jesus insists that Peter go and tell her that he has come. Peter goes into the room and expects to hear angry words of rejection. But he's surprised to find that she is open to Jesus' visit. Jesus enters the room and goes to a low bed where he finds a little old woman, gray-haired, thin, breathing with great difficulty, face flushed, and high temperature. And we pick up the scene on page 320 and 21, the last paragraphs. Jesus bends over the little bed, smiles at the old woman, and he says, "Are you in pain?" And then she says, "I am dying." "No, you will not die. Do you believe that I can cure you? Why would you want to do that? You do not know me. For Simon, who asked me, and for you, to give your soul time to see and love the light. Simon, it would be better if he..." How come Simon thought of me? "Because he is better than you think," Jason says, I know him, and I'm sure. I know him, and I'm happy to satisfy him. Notice he's clearing the way for Simon and that bad relationship between the two of them. Would you cure me then? I will not die then? No, woman, you will not die as yet. Can you believe in me? I believe. It is enough for me not to die. Jesus smiles once again, takes her hand, and her wrinkled hand with swollen veins disappears in the younger hand of Jesus, who stands straight up and takes the attitude he normally assumes when working a miracle. And he shouts, be cured. I want it. Get up. And he lets her hand go, and her hand falls down without any complaint, whereas before, notwithstanding Jesus had taken it very gently, she groaned when it was moved. There's silence for a few moments. Then the old woman cries out, O God of our fathers, but there's nothing wrong with me. I'm cured. Come, come. Her daughters-in-law rush in. Look, says the old woman, I can move, and I feel no pain, and I'm no longer feverish. Feel how cool I am. And my heart no longer feels like the blacksmith's hammer. Ah, I'm not dying any longer. And yet not one word for the Lord. Well, at this point, when Jesus doesn't mind that she fails to thank him, he orders the oldest daughter-in-law to dress her so that she can get up, and she's now well. And now Peter goes to her and reminds her that she ought to be thankful to Jesus for her cure. And so at the top of page, in the middle of page 321, we pick this up. The mother-in-law says, certainly, I wasn't thinking of that. Thank you. What can I do to thank you? She's saying that to Jesus. And Jesus says, be good, very good, because the Eternal Father has been good to you. And if it is not too much trouble for you, allow me to rest in your home today. I have been to all the nearby villages the past week, and I arrived here at dawn this morning. I am tired. Oh, certainly, she says. You may stay if you wish. But there's not much enthusiasm in her words. Jesus, Peter, Andrew, James, and John go and sit down in the kitchen garden. Master, yes, Peter, I feel humiliated. Jesus makes a gesture which meant, never mind. He then goes on, she's not the first and will not be the last who do not feel immediate gratitude. But I do not seek gratitude. All I want is to give souls the chance to save themselves. I do my duty. Let them do theirs. Now, when Jesus finishes speaking of the lack of gratitude of some people, Peter asks if there were other such occasions. And Jesus mentions the time when he went to the home of a very rich mother, a very sick mother in Nazareth. When he arrived there, the husband and a brother drove him away because they considered Jesus a rebel and might get into trouble with the synagogue. Yet Jesus cured her in spite of that. Still, the woman's daughter, Sarah, was punished for speaking to Jesus by the husband. And Peter said that he would have returned the woman to her illness if he had anything to do about it. At this, Jesus severely reprimands Peter, because his big mouth, is open at the wrong time, says the wrong thing, for failing to remember the teachings that he has received. So, on page 322, Peter says at the middle of the page, it is true, Master, I'm a real beast. Forgive me, but I cannot bear the fact that they do not love you. Oh, Peter, you will see much greater indifference. You will have many surprises, Peter. People that the so-called holy world scorns as being money changers, who instead will set an example in the world, an example which will not be followed by those who despise them, heathens, who will be my most faithful ones, prostitutes, who will become pure by strong willpower and penance, sinners, who amend their way of living. Listen, that a sinner amends his way, it may well be, but a prostitute and a money changer. You do not believe it? I do not. You are mistaken, Simon. But here is your mother-in-law coming towards us. So Peter's mother-in-law now invites Jesus to sit at her table. She serves him and Peter with plenty of roasted fish and also in soup. Meanwhile, she's reproaching Peter for leaving his fishing and laying a burden of helping the family to other brothers-in-law. But Peter defends himself, saying that he follows the master. But she doesn't excuse him, saying that he doesn't earn any money. She also uses some very disparaging words, saying, and here are the words that I said that she would use for him: "You are a sluggard. You will never be a prophet or a priest. You are an ignorant sinner, a good for nothing." And Peter cannot take any more, and he says, "You're lucky that the master is here. Otherwise, like Jimmy, like what's his name, Gleason, what Jackie Gleason, someday, how?" I thought of Gleason when I read this for the first time. At this, Jesus draws a compromise and says that Peter can go fishing even there at his mother-in-law's place whenever Jesus is in the area, as well as being with him. As for James and John, Peter's partners, Jesus says that they will come with him because the two disciples say that their parents have no objections to their being with Jesus. And now a little boy appears in the doorway, and he asks for Jesus. Jesus embraces him and sits him on his knees, giving him a bit of fish and a slice of bread. The boy now gives Jesus a purse with a message from a secret donor who told him to give it to the rabbi of Nazareth and to pray for him. Jesus promised to pray for him. Now, I'm going to break the secret here. The apostles were very curious about this. Jesus was getting a secret gift, and they were wondering who it was. Meantime, Jesus as God was ministering to this man. And you know who that was? Matthew, the tax collector. See? He wanted his charity to be secret, because Jesus did appear, came there and touched his heart, but he made no change of his life. But he began to think, and Jesus saw that he had a good heart, so in all his travels, in the meantime, as God, he was ministering to him. And only Jesus knew who it was, although Matthew thought Jesus didn't know. See? So then Jesus tells Peter that the purse is for the poor. They empty it on the table and count the coins. It's a large sum, and has been the same amount a number of times. The boy refuses to reveal the identity of the donor to Peter, who tries to get him to reveal the identity. Jesus approves of the boy's determination. So now Peter asks, "Master, do you know who the person is?" And so we pick up the conversation here on page 324. Now, Jesus doesn't reply. He's busy with a child, to whom he gives another bit of roasted fish, after removing all the bones. But Peter insists, and Jesus is obliged to answer, "Simon, I know everything." Now, we accept that. But Simon didn't know what that really meant until after many months when Jesus said this and this and this, and Simon had to conclude, he must be God. And then he says, "And we are not to know," Peter says, "and will you never be cured of your fall?" Jesus says to Simon Peter. He reproaches him, but smiles at the same time, and he adds, "You will soon know, because if evil wants to be hidden and cannot always be such, good, even if it wants to be hidden, to be meritorious, will be made known one day for the glory of God, whose nature shines in one of his sons." The nature of God, love. And this person understands all that because he loves his neighbors. Go, James, take my blessing to that person. And that's where the vision ends. So then, any question on what we've taken so far? Don't you think it was very neat how Jesus got the devil himself to witness who he was? Before the objector, who probably was a Pharisee. And he had the people, in other words, verify that Jesus didn't know the demoniac, never met him, and they could not believe that out of his mouth came words that never came from him before. And they had to acknowledge, in other words, that whatever voice that was, since they believed in possession, that would have to be that of a demon. Well, be careful that you're not seeing the devil everywhere. See? Because not all evil is necessarily inspired by the devil. There are people in the world who have bad habits, like a drug addict. All right? It's his drug addiction that destroys his conscience, that just buries any sense of wrong or right, and he would kill his mother to get the money that he needs for a fix. That's what what's crying out in him is for that drug. And it destroys everything else.
That's different from the devil being.
Yes. But a spirit of evil can also move a person to drug addiction in order to destroy the person. But we need to protect ourselves today in many ways. Our Blessed Mother in Medjugorje said that. Have sacred objects in every room and on your person. So wear a cross or a scapular of Our Lady Mount Carmel. And in the rooms of your home, it shows that this home belongs to the Lord. And also, at time to time, you have that prayer that I wrote, and it's on the table there, for deliverance from evil presences. Say it morning and evening. Cover your night and all your day. Well, that's only because the Lord permits that at times. The Lord permits that at times. And he allows the person to defend themselves, and he helps them. Well, you have to be careful what and when that happens. And who's responsible for it? The Lord will not tempt us beyond our strength, as St. Paul, but with a temptation will give us a way out. It's inconceivable that God, in his love and mercy for us, would allow us to be overcome by the spirit of evil. Besides, if you're in a state of grace, you are indwelt by God. And you then use the name Jesus to protect yourself from what we call an obsessive presence outside of you, from pestering you.
So it wouldn't be wrong if I was to think that if I was fearing or having anxieties in that direction, that I would say, I would pray Jesus and Mary to get it away so fast, that Jesus and Mary, the evil spirit, what?
Don't blame everything on the spirit of evil. He gets too much credit.
Well, I know.
It's our own weakness sometimes that moves us into anxiety and fears.
Well, then you don't know.
I know. But best proof is to say that prayer, and if your anxiety is still there, it's not Satan. It's our own weakness. It's our own weakness. It's the fears that we allow to overrun us. Then our imagination works on that, and first you know you're wiped out. So the best thing to say there is, Jesus, I trust you. Place everything in your hands. I don't know the answer for this. These bills that are here, we're out of work, we're out of food or whatever. But you know the answer. I place it in your hands. You'll be at peace.
No, I don't mean in the sense of everyday living. I meant in the sense of you really feeling you're going to get closer to God and you're worried about the evil coming.
Well, don't worry about him. In other words, don't be Satan conscious. No. Be Jesus conscious. Yes, Kathleen. Yes.
Thank you.
Well, just remember now, Jesus said, in my name, you will cast out devils. Mm-hmm. The name is Jesus. All right? The name is Jesus. And do you remember my story of Satan having a garage sale?
Yes. Yeah.
How many remember that story? Should I tell it again?
Yes.
Wouldn't that be the day when Satan was going out of business?
Yeah,
someday. Well, we hope soon, when the Lord is supposed to be coming in a special way, that he will just put him in his place. But the story is that he's having a garage sale. Now, who would attend that garage sale? Well, at any rate, he has all his tools laid out. But his pricing is crazy. Brand new tools cost 2 cents, 5 cents. And as the tools are more used, they become more precious. Until you come to the end of the line, and there's an old bent old screwdriver, and it's worth $2,000. So this man is shopping, and he looks at the tools. Then he goes up to Satan and says, Mr. Satan, I don't understand your pricing here. If I were to put prices on these tools, that brand new power saw there, I'd put $2,000 on that. And that old bent screwdriver, I'd throw it away. If I charged anything, it would be a penny. And Satan said, now look here. I did my best work with that tool. Turned it over. When he turned it over, the name on it said, discouragement. Was one of his most subtle, frequent temptations. Think of yourself. Make a retreat. You promise to pray. You're going to pray a half hour a day. Oh, you're fine for three weeks. Fourth week, things begin to pop up. Now it's down to 15 minutes. And then 10 minutes. And then 5 minutes. Then after 2 months, gone. Discouragement. Why? Because when you pray a half hour, you don't see results. And he's back there bombarding and saying, huh, you wasted your time. What have you got for a half hour, huh? Can you see what you did there? See, you don't know whether those thoughts are yours or his. So discouragement has prevented many people from moving on to high sanctity. His best temptation. He's at his best when he's most subtle, when you don't think he's there. And the most awful temptation is to believe he doesn't exist. Then he can go to work on you and you don't even know it. See, I met a priest who said he doesn't believe in Satan. And I said, with all your knowledge, you better not interpret the doubt in his favor. Because if he exists, you're in trouble. If you saw a tank coming down the road and you bury your head in the sand and said it doesn't exist, what do you think would happen? Any question on some of the things that we've had here? Yes.
I just wanted to ask one question, Father. I know a person, last couple of weeks, a friend of mine, son died, and they say this boy was an alcoholic all his life, but the night that he died, they really don't know where he died from, but he just died, you know? Mm-hmm. But this disease of alcohol, alcohol took him over. Do you think that he would be severely punished for that?
That would depend on how fully aware he was that he was getting into the habit of drink. Only God could assess that, and we should leave that to him. We would hope that he's merciful, and God is. Any other question?
I was going to say before, when you were talking about the Jews who are conscious of the presence of the devil, do you think today that the Jewish people as a whole are conscious of the devil as a, and, you know, something in the world? I don't see that.
Well, they believed in an evil presence, an evil spirit.
I don't see that now.
Well, that may be. That I don't know, because I haven't had any close relationship with what we might call Jewish friends. But in the Old Testament, yes. And even at the time of Jesus, they believed in possession, and they had cases of such instances of possession.
Because if you don't believe that, you know, evil exists in the world and there's anything wrong, then everything is, to them, everything is wrong.
Well, it's not that that there's no evil. The evil they claim is from our own nature, and it's not from an evil presence. So they're discounting, in other words, they're. Then the Satan has what do we call that? A field day.
yeah.
A field day. Just goes to work and no problem.
We had they always say that the press is controlled by the Jewish monopoly. I don't know what most of the press, this is what my friends tell me who went to these things. And we had a big funeral mass in our parish yesterday with Officer Guns. And a lot of, you know, cameramen were there and the TV stations. So I looked at the news to see what was going to be said. And the funny thing was they never showed the church. They never mentioned the name of the church. They just said he was buried from Queens Village. That to me is almost denying that he was a Catholic. It was mm-hmm. I really believe there.
But that isn't true in other cases. I've seen television programs in the funeral round in Long Island and New York. And from the church, you saw them carrying the casket out of the church.
No. They mentioned
the church on TV.
I'm saying, now they're getting us that way. I'm not even saying it's a Catholic church. I'm getting myself all worked up.
But they do slant the news, on abortion especially.
That's what I'm saying. I felt that was being slanted.
They give more time to abortion than they do to pro-life.
That's true. Yes, this is what I'm saying.
And they always end up with the abortion side last. That's what sticks in your mind most.
Getting all about issues. It's very good. Thank you for telling us about
mm-hmm. But I don't want to move too much into that if we have questions on this. And by the way, too, when you're reading this and you have questions, why, write them out. See, before you come. Or as I'm sharing this and a question comes up, write it down. Because if you say, well, I'll remember this, then you forget. Because we do want some questions here. I mean, your point of view. And it often helps to clarify this as we talk about it.
Well, the part about when he was telling Peter, Peter was kind of talking with his mother, and I was surprised that he didn't. You know, when the Lord took you, we saw him in the peace, and I was wondering why he was letting us go back and forth when it's usually around him, and we're always having him in the peace. I didn't understand that.
Oh, no. So you're talking about the Lord should step in right away when there's an argument and stop it.
Well,
he allowed the apostles often when they were on the road and they were carrying on conversation. He was sometimes 10 yards ahead of them alone, praying and in his own thoughts. But he knew what was going on back there. He'd let it go on until it came to a head. And then he'd say, what were you talking about? Sometimes they were ashamed, yes, but he wanted them to reveal it, see? And so when they did, he gave them the answer. And then sometimes he rebuked them because they were like little children and they were they were being judgmental. And he was strong on that, especially when the Pharisees opposed Jesus and the apostles were ready, to throw stones back at them or to really use clubs on them or whatever. And Jesus, don't return evil for evil. He lived what he said. You see, a beautiful, heroic example of how Jesus lived what he said and asked the apostles to do.
Yeah, but then there are people who read also in the Bible, a stone for a stone, or, you know.
Well, Old Testament is Old Testament. The New Testament corrects the Old Testament and fulfills it and perfects it. That's what we go by.
So whenever anybody refers to the Old Law, you've got to tell them there's a New Law.
Yes, you must equate it or measure it with what's said in the New Testament. The Old Testament, yes, eye for eye, but Jesus said, forgive even your enemies. He did that on the cross. He changed that that axiom that the Jews use, eye for eye, tooth for tooth.
Because in today's world, even with the Newer Testament and the Newer Bible, people who are always bringing up the Old Testament to one point in today's world that really is mind-boggling and annoying.
Well, don't argue with them if they stay with that.